Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And I think it's the ultimate proof of what Trump really wants. He wants fealty in his subordinates. He doesn't want loyalty. Loyalty is a virtue. Mm-hmm. He wants submission. He wants people who will do what he tells him.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. I'm delighted to be joined today by Ambassador John Bolton, one of the most knowledgeable figures in foreign policy in my lifetime, and a guy who has been to the rodeo many, many times. And so, Ambassador, I know we're on a limited clock today, so I wanted to start up right away with you. I want to ask a question that is the impact of this trade war that we're presently in. It seems to me, and I want to get your thoughts on this, that the Trump administration has really stepped in a minefield here, and they're opening up a lot of space for China to use this trade war to build more economic and political military relationships throughout Asia and Africa. I wanted to get your take on that, the risks that that poses.
Well, I think the risks are very severe. I think there are obvious economic problems with the tariffs and the negative effect it will have on the U.S. economy. We don't know how great the effect will be. There's a lot of speculation about it. I think we're now at the point where hopes and fears have balanced out, and we're going to have to rely on data to tell us exactly what's going to happen. And there's a lot of uncertainty that's been introduced into the economy, quite apart from the tariff rates. Those facts also affect us internationally, where I think there is a political impact, and it's measured in qualitative terms of our friends and allies, especially in Europe, in Asia, around the world, saying, what are they doing over there? Why are they imposing these burdens on us? If we've got problems, let's try and work them out. And rather than focus on the real bad actor in international trade, which is China, which steals our intellectual property, subsidizes their firms against ours, they've never really opened their domestic market the way they promised to, why not go after that with our friends together in a coalition, as opposed to having a general Hobbesian war of all against all. And what this has done is ripped through decades of effort by Americans, government, private sector, to build up relationships of good faith, goodwill, trust, reliance. That it's hard, you can't put it in dollars and cents terms, but it's going to hurt us because people now doubt our reliability and our credibility. China is definitely trying to step into that gap that we've created. They've certainly worked hard in Asian countries to say, look, let's stick together against this new American policy. And they're going to exploit it in Europe and elsewhere by right. people who simply don't understand why we've abandoned what we have advocated consistently since 1945, which is open trade relations. Look, we've got legitimate national security concerns about items that we should manufacture here. We
100%
shouldn't have them manufactured in China. All of these things are correctable without blowing up the international trading system, which is what we're on the verge of doing.
Yeah, it strikes me that the international system of alliances that we built meticulously from 1945 on, not always perfectly, but meticulously, the combination of trade, diplomacy, shared values, and military alliances made America much safer in the world. It continues to baffle me why we've walked away from that combination of of soft and hard power. I mean, abandoning USAID. I'm sure that the sacks of rice and soybeans that are going to appear in Africa now, they're going to have Mandarin on them instead of USAID. Talk about how that soft power opportunity for China in places like Africa, which is a globally contested field now, is going to play out.
Right. Well, I speak as an alumnus of AID and the Reagan administration back when we were trying to reform it to make it more market oriented. And this idea of using economic assistance to influence events in other countries is an old phenomenon. People can read Caesar's commentaries about his wars in Gaul and the effect that the Romans made of them. And look, I have no doubt after 8 years of Obama and then 4 more years of Biden, there were plenty of things to reform in USAID, reflecting back to the Reagan days. We didn't want it to be a world welfare agency. We wanted it to be something that promoted economic growth in countries of interest to us. That's why it was the inheritor of the Marshall Plan legacy. So I'm entirely on board with the idea that change was needed. But what they did was like the briefing officer in Vietnam who said, well, we had to destroy that village in order to save it. You know, it's not the most persuasive thing to do. And I would couple with what they did in AID to what they've done to our minimal information statecraft capabilities in the Voice of America, mm-hmm. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Marty, Radio Free Asia. You know, were they perfect? Of course not. Could they use substantial reform and upgrading? Absolutely. What have we done? We've shut our only communications vehicle off from the rest of the world at a time when with rising tensions and adversaries trying to take advantage of us, we've just left the field. So we're going to build these capabilities back, I'll guarantee, in some future administration. The total cost of destroying them and then building them back may well be higher than if we had just tried to reform them internally like we did in the Reagan years. But that's part of the cost of the Trump administration.
So we talked a little bit about China here and their global position right now. The other major story, I think, that is and will continue to be the big question of our time is how does Europe and the United States respond to Ukraine and the Russian invasion, the Russian war crimes? And I've you know, I'm sure you've been as disappointed as I am, but not necessarily surprised by the constant sort of capitulation messages from Vance and Rubio and Trump and Witkoff, where they have made their position about who they really favor in this story very clear. Talk to me. You've seen a lot of diplomacy vis-a-vis the Russians. Talk to me about how unusual and disturbing this is for our country to be siding essentially with the aggressor in a war that could set Europe aflame.
Well, it's unprecedented, not just in modern times, but throughout American history. This is a reflection both of the isolationist tendency within the Republican Party that's unfortunately surfaced again. Vance is the principal mm-hmm. example of that, but also of Trump, who doesn't have a philosophy of any sort, but whose instincts often skew isolationist. And also because of his unique view of international affairs, he believes that if he has a friendship with a foreign head of state, then the U.S. has good relations with that country. So if he's good friends with Vladimir Putin, then things are fine between the U.S. and Russia. Now, look, personal relations have their place. There's no doubt about it. But Vladimir Sure. Putin doesn't think he's friends with Donald Trump. He thinks, former KGB agent that Putin is, that he can manipulate Trump. And he has been manipulating him on Ukraine consistently. So the impression that this gives to our allies is that we've lost a strategic sense. Vance and others, right. Vance said during, I think, the 22 Senate campaign in Ohio, that he didn't care what happened in Ukraine.
I think it's ridiculous that we're focused on this border in Ukraine. I got to be honest with you. I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or another.
And I tell you, I do care what happens in Ukraine. And we should, because after our experience in the 20th century, we've believed for 75 plus years that peace and stability in Europe are a vital American national interest for economic reasons, political, military reasons. So the act of unprovoked aggression, the second invasion of Ukraine in the past 15 years that Russia carried out, in February of 22, negatively impacted American security here at home. And, you know, I think our politicians have let us down since the end of the Soviet Union. They failed to make the case effectively that a forward American foreign policy, a strong Reaganite kind of policy, benefits us at home. And if we don't protect our interest in the wider world, nobody else is going to do it for us. We're not doing this because we're nice people, although we are. We're doing it because it benefits us, and people need to hear that case being made, which Biden didn't do, and Trump doesn't understand it.
Yeah, I disagreed a lot with Jake Sullivan on how he approached the post-22 post-invasion moment, where it seemed to be the most delicate sort of, like, we don't really want to get involved, but we'll do the minimum for the until the pain level gets too high. We'll be right back. And now back to the show. The point person on a lot of this negotiation with Russia has been Stephen Witkoff, who strikes me as someone who should never be allowed near diplomacy, national security, or anything else. Have you ever seen anybody who's a weaker player up when they're a counterparty to Putin? Again, as you mentioned, ex-KGB, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is a very sophisticated and determined organization. I feel like Witkoff deserves more attention than he gets, because this strikes me as you know, Trump has sent somebody who is way underneath the par for this kind of assignment.
No, it's a stunning choice, not just in Ukraine, but with respect to Iran. And I think it's the ultimate proof of what Trump really wants. He wants fealty in his subordinates. He doesn't want loyalty. Loyalty is a virtue. Mm-hmm. He wants submission. He wants people who will do what he tells him. And in Witkoff, he's writing on a blank page. You know, in his various responsibilities, Witkoff didn't know anything about the Gaza Strip. He doesn't know anything about Russia. He doesn't know anything about Ukraine. He doesn't know anything about Iran. He doesn't know anything about nuclear weapons. He doesn't know anything about arms control and nonproliferation. And this is our lead negotiator on two of the most sensitive and potentially dangerous issues we've got. He reports directly to Trump what Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State and now National Security Advisor's actual role in all this is hard to discern. But this is not in the best interest of the United States. We do not have the A team on the field here.
Yeah, I think one thing, you know, is as much as I've had some disagreements with Marco in the last few years, he knows what's going on. Marco is a more sophisticated thinker about foreign policy than Trump, and most certainly than Witkoff. But I think you're right. I think it's hard to tell how much latitude Trump actually gives him when you see Witkoff in the fore of all of these things. I wanted to jump for a moment because you mentioned Iran, which as much as, you know, it's that old dictum. You may not be interested in what Iran is doing, but Iran is interested in you. And right now, Trump is saying, oh, we've got a deal. Iran's saying we don't have a deal. Talk to me about where you see the state of play in the Middle East right now, because I think Iran is not less dangerous than it's been before. In fact, it's probably more so. And I'm curious where you see the state of play in that moment right now.
Well, I think we could be at a hinge point in the very near future. You know, this disagreement about whether Iran should be allowed to enrich uranium for civil reactor purposes is not a new debate. This has been going on for a long time.
True.
And the central flaw
since George W.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And the central flaw of the 2015 Obama deal was to give Iran any uranium enrichment capability at all, because although the percentage of enrichment you need to get for the U-235 isotope sounds wildly different, once you've enriched to reactor grade levels, you have fundamentally accomplished about two thirds of the work you need to
do. You're most of the way there
to weapons grade levels. So they shouldn't have it at all. And indeed, when the U.S. licenses nuclear technology for civil reactors around the world, and most of it is our technology, even though we don't build them anymore, we typically insist that a recipient government promise not to do uranium enrichment and not to do reprocessing of the spent fuel to get plutonium out. So our allies in the Gulf region have said, you won't allow us to enrich uranium, but you permitted the Iranians to do it. Explain that one to us. And of course, there is no good explanation. So this is not a question of, you know, shall I put my building on 57th Street in Manhattan or 56th Street? This is the core issue. Sure. That Witkoff doesn't seem to understand. I don't see there's any acceptable deal. And what that means is, I think the question before the Israelis right now is, how much longer are we going to wait and take the risk that Iran will get a deliverable nuclear weapon, or when are we going to act against that program? Trump himself, in his letter to the Ayatollah Khamenei, it's three and a half months ago now, said, I'll give you 2 months to talk. Well, I think we're pretty close to the end of the 2 months. There isn't a deal coming here, so we'll see whether Trump's red line remains or whether he wants really to do more talking.
Yeah, I think in some ways Iran has to be feeling a lot of its own clock pressure with Syria, with the Israelis and Gaza, with the Saudis trying to. I mean, this is one of the like old dirty secrets that everyone's always known. If the Saudis wanted to make nuclear weapons, they would probably find a way to do it.
Well, they could rent them from Pakistan very quickly. I mean, it's not hard to do. It'd be true for any of the Gulf Arabs. And, you know, their strategic view of the Iranian threat, both the nuclear program and the terrorist threat, is essentially identical to Israel's these days. That's where the Abraham Accords came from. There was important diplomacy involved, but it's because the strategic interests are aligned. And in the Middle East today, the biggest threat to peace and security, bar none, is Iran.
I think that's exactly right. And that, you know, things I've heard from folks in the Gulf in the last 5 years have always been like they desperately wanted some sort of an accord, a deal with Bibi that they could, you know, take not only to their people, but would secure a sort of de facto or de jure alliance against Iran that even if they armed up, they would be facing a truly formidable and unified opposition across the rest of the Middle East.
Yeah, and what the Gulf Arabs want from us is assurance that we're going to remain there, that we're not going to retreat, that we're not going to buy the argument that these days Europe doesn't matter, the Middle East doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is China in Asia. The fact is, when we withdraw from a region, China appears, and they'd like nothing better than to have closer links to Iran. Iran is one of the outriders in what's emerging as the China-Russia axis. It will be a major problem for us for the rest of the century.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. I wonder if you have any thoughts about where does American diplomacy and national security policy go in a post-Trump era? I know we've only got about 5 minutes left, and that's kind of a big question for 5 minutes. But, you know, I'm starting to think we are going to reach the end of Trump. There will be an ending to Trump. And this country's going to have to reset, I think, in a lot of different ways. And you know, as a conservative, I still view our NATO-centric and alliance-centric foreign policy, and I view deterrence as valuable. Where do you see us having to reset most as we go forward in a post-Trump era?
Well, I agree. I think people need to think about the post-Trump era. And I don't think he's going to run for a third term. I think some of his recent interviews naming Vance and Rubio as possible successors, he knows it. Now, there's danger there because that removes a political guardrail. He knows he never has to face the voters again. It's the poor Republican House and Senate members that are going to have to do that next year. But I believe out in the country, I think most Republicans still have a Reaganite Bush approach. They believe in peace through strength, what Reagan meant when he said that, not what Trump means. And they understand the virtue of a strong foreign policy. I think particularly in Congress and especially in the House, a lot of members are intimidated by Trump. They worry about a Trump primary opponent, particularly the House members, if they get nominated, they're going to win in November, but they need to protect against a competition from a Trumper. And it's interesting if Elon Musk is really pulling back from politics now, that's one part of that threat removed. But they may be intimidated, but they don't agree with it. They go along because it's the convenient thing to do. So I guess that's good news and bad news. But the good news is I think the party will snap back quicker than people think. It will depend a lot on the threats we face around the world. And one point on which I do think Republicans agree, and a lot of Democrats too, is the threat from China. So that is something that I think helps focus people's attention. I think the other tent pole is Israel. Support for Israel is very strong in the Republican Party, stronger than in the Democratic Party.
Yep.
And that's where the next test may come. So all of these pressures that are below the surface, makes me optimistic 44 months from now that things will start to change. And I think maybe even after the 26th election, they'll begin to change.
I think 26 may actually cause some resets, because a lot of these vulnerable Republicans on domestic problems are going to lose those seats.
Yeah.
I think the more he seems like he's not the determining factor of every election, every primary election in particular, the more people can be free to move back to the central tendencies of which, you know, we were all raised in the Republican Party back in the day. You know, I do think one other thing you mentioned is like there is an overlap on a lot of these things with Democrats as well these days. There is a bigger overlap than there's been on the China question in particular than there has been in a long time. And I would love to get back to a Scoop Jackson kind of feel in the Democratic Party here and there, so that there's a sense of national purpose on foreign policy questions, not just partisan or siloed purpose in those things.
Yeah, there really isn't a national security wing on the Democratic side now. I mean, it's hard to find the Democrats in Washington these days.
Correct.
Since the election. I don't know what they're doing, but I think having a robust debate will lead people to believe that our interests lie in presence in the world, and that we've just mm-hmm. gotten lazy after the fall of the Berlin Wall in making the case to people. And a political leader or leaders who can emerge, who know how to do that and combine it with attractive domestic policies, I think are going to be very interesting candidates, maybe as early as 28.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Ambassador John Bolton, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time, as always. Great wisdom and insight on foreign and national security policy, as always. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, I'd look forward to it. Thanks for having me. I
want to thank everybody for listening today, and we will see you again on the next episode of the Lincoln Project Podcast. The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.